This is Sean with Voices of Racing. I'm speaking with Greg Tyler. Greg, how you doing?
Doing pretty good.
All right, so just kind of give a little bit of your background. What year were you born? What city? And what were your parents' names?
My parents' names were Paul and Yvonne Tyler. Interesting story on that. I was supposed to be born in Kansas, but mom ended up giving birth to me at the boarding area at San Francisco Airport.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And what day and year was that?
That was August 19th of 1965.
1965. And your father?
Paul Tyler, yes.
And what were their industries, or what did they do?
He was a supervisor for aircraft maintenance for Transworld Airlines at SFO.
And TWA. And then your
Correct.
Mom, was she just basically took care of you guys, or did she also have her own career?
She was chief nurse for the Palo Alto Veterans Administration.
All right. So what city did you grow up in?
That's kind of hard to say also. I grew up both in California and Topeka, Kansas, and went to school in both places. And I guess for the most part, I grew up in San Bruno, where San Francisco Airport really is.
Okay. And what high school did you go to, and what did you end up wanting to study as you went from high school into college?
High school was Oceana High School in Pacifica. General ed there, I was basically just kind of prepping myself for the aviation industry. I knew early on in life that I wanted to be involved in aviation some type of way. My original goal was to be a pilot. In fact, that was a dream ever since I learned the alphabet, was to be a pilot for TWA, yeah.
All right, so what were the first kind of experiences you had, and how young also to, not, you know, to kind of dovetail a little bit, but how young were you when you also got your love of racing, and what was that experience?
That started very early on as well. About 4 years old, and was introduced and started in quarter midgets there at the original Bay Lance in Sunnyvale, California. And both of my parents were gearheads, and so my brothers and I, we were going to be involved in some form of motorsports one way or another. And quarter midgets was the perfect outlet.
So you started doing that in grade school and went into high school doing that as well?
Correct. We started that in the late 60s and did that, yeah, right up through high school and moved into from half midgets or quarter midgets into half midgets. And ran a TQ out of Carnegie in Livermore. And picked up an old Edmunds midget in, what was that, 84, 85 for the autocraft. And probably should have stayed with the midget. That was the most fun. That really was. Learned a lot there. Had a lot of support from some great people, especially out in BCRA. Floyd Alves, Hank Butcher. Great people to learn from.
So
then tried to run a sprint car and ran broke, and that pretty much killed that program. By that time, I was starting my own fatherhood. My son Ryan had just been born, and so yeah, shattered dreams.
All right, so you being African American and going into the sport, was there anybody else that you knew in that region that also was running, male or female?
The only people running that looked anything close to me was my older brother. We started at the same time. My cousin Mark Graves down in Los Angeles, and a girl named Cheryl Glass up in Seattle.
So what did you, like, for instance, for Cheryl, she was, you know, the only female that you just listed off. What did you know about her, and what was kind of the word in the industry about her?
We met, say 72, no, 72 was Huntsville. We met in 73, the Grand Nationals in Baylands, and she was a few years older than me, but she was a great driver. She really was. And just a total sweetheart. A really nice person. And fish with the hammer down. But even with that, I mean, she definitely raced you clean, and she was aggressive, but she didn't take any mess off of the guys, and she held her own. And she kind of operated, shall we say, under the radar. I mean, we had no idea that she was even involved until like I said, the Grand Nationals, and that's actually where we met and established a good friendship ever since.
Yeah, and she ended up passing away. Do you remember, like, what year, around what time that she'd passed away?
I forget specifically the year. She had so much going for her between the racing, the modeling.
And she got in the Sprint Car Hall of Fame, right?
Yes. I'm trying to remember what year she was inducted into that. And that was really happy for her, for all of us, because it proved that you know, not only that it could be done and that the opportunities were there. I just wish more people of all backgrounds would take an interest in it, especially open wheel racing. Just a lot of fun. The camaraderie there was learned a lot. Learned a lot. That was
so. How would you
parts of my life?
Yeah. How would you compare kind of society's view on, you know, when African Americans would come on the track with their teams, comparison to, you know, what it always seemed to be the norm, and what were maybe some situations that you remember of kind of having to deal with that, and now if you could kind of speak to those moments at all.
Well, okay, for me, when we ran, when we had they held the Grand Nationals, the QMA Grand Nationals in Huntsville, Alabama at 72, was an eye-opening experience. I'd never been down there. And I remember when we signed in, the people there were actually, the people that signed us in were great, because they gave us the heads up. I said, introduced themselves to us and signed us in and says, hey, listen, you know, welcome to Huntsville. We strongly suggest that if you camp out here to you know, remain on the grounds overnight, so on and so forth. And, you know, because the things were still rough at the time, and for people of color. And they were really nice. Bill Haas. In fact, he was actually the president of QMA, and he met us there in Huntsville and just treated us great, introduced us to key people. And with that, I mean, there were some people who thought that we shouldn't be there. But all in all and in general, you know, it was a wonderful experience. Wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
Okay. So as you progressed in the industry, what were some of the other types of cars that you drove, and how did you get into training individuals?
Well, on that, the goal was to actually to get to Indy. That's what my goal was. I just wanted to come up through the open wheel ranks. And see, from my position, I wasn't trying to make a statement or anything. I just enjoyed the spirit of competition. We met some great friends that to this day are like extended family. And, you know, we just loved it. But my goal was to get to Indy. So, yeah, like I say, you know, we ran quarter midgets, half midgets, TQs, full midgets, ran sprint car, ran broke. And from that point, we did a lot of motorsport photography, and that was great. In fact, it was a BCRA official, Tom Palmer, had said, hey, you know, being a former driver as a photographer, you can capture things from an angle and a perspective that regular photographers can't. Would you consider doing this? And sure. And that worked out really well. Got published through Racing Wheels and National Speed Sport, Arietta Racing News, a few other racing newspapers and magazines and whatnot. And then got into officiating, and was an official for the Bay Cities Racing Association. That was nice. I also worked with USAC Western States under Tommy Hunt, Bob Poole, and learned a lot there. When you grow up, Benny, you do what you can to stay involved. So
who are some of the mentors that you were able to work with, and kind of preceding that, who are some of the guys you looked up to that you'd love to even talk to or, you know, mirror their style, you know, as you progressed up through the ranks?
As drivers, well, let me see, even in as far as my quarter midget days, Norm Rapp, a guy who was just awesome on the West Coast, lived in San Francisco. We bought a lot of fuel and tires and stuff. Bill Ferrari, he was the Northern California West Coast distributor for Curtis Chassis, Curtis Quarter Midget Chassis at the time. And he had a couple of daughters that raced, Julie and Jenny. They were older than me as well. They raced with my older brother. But they were really good. And so that's how we got our first Curtis Chassis. So between Bill Ferrari, Norm Rapp, Floyd Alves, Hank Butcher, those were probably some of the most instrumental guys, especially early in my career. And then when it come to working with USAC, Tommy Hunt and Bob Poole and Mike Hargis, Jerry Guevara, John and Mike Estefalin, just great guys to learn from. Norm Shields, he was running the Silver Crown operation with USAC. I really learned a lot from him. He took me under his wing, showed me a lot of ins and outs and how to deal with various situations when you had to disqualify somebody or whatever.
All right, so
I was fortunate. I was blessed to have a lot of really good people. Wally Pancratz, he was big in my midget career. I ended up tearing up a car of his down at Ascot, but he was very instrumental in my midget career. I was very fortunate. I had a lot of good people along my path.
Well, you just kind of brought up another point, is that it's a dangerous sport. So how many different situations that you felt were a little bit too close to the edge of really being seriously injured, and, you know, or were there any situations that you were seriously injured?
I've had my share of that, but even still, I was never in a situation where I felt, okay, I can get killed doing this, because I knew that going in, you know. Fortunately, through as early as quarter midgets, we were taught at an early age that safety starts between the ears. You know, don't get in over your head, don't drive over your head. Both of my shoulders, my left one in particular, are still jacked up from a nasty ride I took at Rio Linda dirt track in Sacramento, right there by McClellan Air Force Base. There was a girl named Linda Brown, her and Scooter Lambert and Tim Clausen and I. We'd just taken the green, sailed it into turn one, and none of us came out of turn two. And all I remember was seeing blue sky and treetops going around in circles as I was flipping. And shoulders have been jacked up ever since. Had a carpet fryer on me up at Eureka, over in turn four, smacked the wall pretty good, sheared the fuel pump off, and up in smoke. That was a scary moment. That was probably the scariest moment. Taking some nasty flips and whatnot, but fire, fryer's nothing to play with. You know, you'd be surprised how fast you can come out of a harness. but yeah.
All right,
yeah,
so
I said, I've torn up some equipment. You know, I've had some injuries myself, but nothing to the point where I'd be like, hey, you know what? Well, it's interesting you ask that question because, like, I look at the kids driving today, and with all my years and whatnot, I would not want to be out there with these kids today. It's a different mindset. It's a totally different mindset, and these drivers are getting younger and younger and younger, and, you know, while they're young, yeah, they can heal up fast and so on and so forth, but because they're young, they're missing out on a lot of valuable seat time. I see, especially in the wing car divisions, I see a lot of overly aggressive maneuvers being made that I know would not even be attempted if they didn't have that wing up there generating downforce. So I tend to lean towards the non-wing, open-wheel dirt. I think probably going to offend a few people when I say this, but I think it's a higher level of discipline.
All right, and you also teach now. If you could kind of touch on what organizations you teach for, and also just kind of the background of how long you've stepped into that role as being a mentor and you know, the younger guys that want to get going in the industry, you know, not just how long you've done it and what maybe also kind of how you program it, like from beginning to end, what are the first things that you want them to you know, essentially dive into what's as far as learning before they really get out there. Just kind of take a little chronological, you know, explanation of how you start them, how you walk them into it, and when they're done working with you, you know, what kind of the outcome is and what's the next level they're usually going towards.
Well, there where we have the GT Motorsports DDP, or Driver Development Program, primarily we take the open road kids out of quarter midget go-karts and help them make the transition into the bigger cars, the half majors, the TQs, the full midgets, the sprint cars, so on and so forth. As far as the basically the mid to sprint silver crown division, you know, the upper echelon. We get drivers out from all around the country, but last 10 to 15 years, we've been getting quite a few from California, which is wonderful. But the first thing we do, first thing I do in particular, before I even put them in the classroom or anything, let alone in a car, is get in their head and find out what their goal is, what the objective is. It's like, are we trying to get to the Indianapolis 500? Are we trying to get to NASCAR? Are we doing this to be a weekend warrior? And see where their head is, and that way I can work with them on their level and help them obtain their goals. And on that note, each one is, you know, pretty much on an individual basis. The basic program runs usually at least a year. Some like staying involved just because we go over things again and again, and some catch on really quick and they get it. And so, like I say, it's pretty much on an individual basis, but. Like I said, the first thing we do is try and see, you know, where their head is and what their goal is. That way we can work accordingly.
So are you also bringing in the simulation machines, or is it all on track?
Well, more classroom than anything. A lot of track time and seat time. But more classroom than anything, because I'm just old school the way I was taught. Mentally, you have to be prepared before you can physically do anything. And so we try to teach not only the basics of motorsports, but, you know, the dynamics of car performance, the dynamics of the engine, how a driver is to become one with a car rather than driving a car. You can look out across the board today and see a bunch of kids out there that are actually driving a car, but there's only a handful that bond with the car and become one. And those are the ones that are being very successful right now. You look at, Justin, what's that kid's last name? I forget him already. He's come a long ways. He's doing really well. He started out, I remember when we first started working with him in Bay Cities. And I'm looking at him now, both sprints and Silver Crown and midgets, and he's holding his own. And this is what we like to see. You know, we want people to be, for one, long term, and to really understand it. And a lot of the driver development program also involves teaching the history of the sport. Okay, we feel that it's vital that these drivers know the history of the sport, you know, what has led up to what it is today at all levels. I think when you see the history of the technology and the safety, you know, these are all things that make you a successful driver, just being able to stand and steer it. Unfortunately, you see a lot of that out there today. But you know, it is what it is.
So what would you say? I don't want you to really have to put a number on it, but top five major advances in technology that have really helped out, one on one side with speed and control, and then the other side with safety. What are some bullet points on both sides that you've seen improvements that have really kind of changed the game as far as with the cars themselves?
Well, again, I'm probably going to rattle a few feathers here, but I'm all in favor of the safer barriers, okay, even on the shorter tracks, because here's the thing. Even with all the new things that we're adding to today's cars, we're still running on the old tracks. I don't care if it's an oval, a road course, a super speedway. We're running on tracks that were built in the late 50s and 60s. Now, granted, there's some newer tracks out there, but the down tubes. I understand the safety concept of it, but once we started putting down tubes on our open wheel cars, guess what we did? We changed the dynamics and the handling characteristics. Because now, where you once had flex, especially there by the motor plate and whatnot, you just made it rigid. So now you have to learn a whole new way on how to drive the beast. Some say it's the greatest thing. I don't know. I'm still on the fence with that particular issue because, like I say, first off, as far as, again, I can't stress it enough, but safety starts between the ears. All right, and I come from the previous generation where as hard as we competed against each other, we still respected each other. All right, and we knew that lives could be lost. And just that mindset alone, the driving styles were different. And I see, like, I'm looking at these new seats where the drivers are literally cocooned in the car. And the simple fact is this, the human body has to have a certain amount of flex. If the body doesn't flex, then certain organs inside become detached. You know, and with the speeds that we're traveling these days, again, on these same old tracks, I think both as a driver and as a fan, in order to really keep the spirit of competition alive, that's what you need, is good, clean competition. The speeds don't really matter. As long as they see people swapping back and forth and jockeying for a position, you got the fans off of their butts and standing on their feet and cheering and screaming and carrying on, and it's a great show.
Right.
That's just my two cents.
All right, so who have been some of the major racers that over the years you've been able to work with on their team or even, you know, in training kind of behind the scenes, and who are some of the major guys in the industry right now you really respect?
Well, let me see. We've had, when we really kicked off the program, there was a guy who's known on the West Coast named Heavy D, great open wheel crew chief, especially in wing sprint cars. And he brought a young man out here named Brad Sweet. I remember him telling me, then he's like, GT, you got to work with this kid, man. You just got to work with him. You're going to like him. He's not hard on equipment. Just gave him a whole spiel. So I'm like, all right, bring him out. So he comes out, and a real young kid, too. He was, my God, an early teenager at the time. And, well, maybe mid-teen. But, yeah, he had his driver's license because he drove the hauler out here. So, either way, now he's, World of Outlaws champion, winning multiple races all over the place. Various divisions. Shane Matthews, he was a good shoe. He came through our program, and Alex Pruitt, that was a really good kid out of Arizona. He tragically lost him in an accident. He had a lot of potential. He was driving for Danny Drinan, and I was a driver coach. Had a really good thing going there. Oh my goodness, Keith Bloom Jr. There's so many names that just escape you right now.
Sure.
I apologize for that.
No, that's fine. So, looking towards the future, looking towards solutions that you feel that need to happen within the industry from the car perspective, from the track perspective, as well as, you know, the training perspective, what would be a few key points for each of those that you've thought about that if they would be implemented could really make a difference?
First off, I'd really like to see, I mean, if we're really going to focus on safety, which motorsports being a dangerous sport should be priority, then let's stop with the acceleration of these kids coming through the ranks, okay? Now, I realize some of these kids are really young and really talented and have natural abilities. I get that. But here's the problem. And it all, it really kind of started with Jeff Gordon and John Bickford. Love them both dearly. We're all still great friends. But when John took Jeff out of California and out of Corder Medus down to Florida, because that was the only state in the country that would let him run a sprint car at that age. Great for Jeff. Absolutely great for Jeff. But it really kind of screwed the program, because now you got parents and car owners thinking, hey, we can take these kids straight out of go-karts and Corder Medus and put them in an 800 horsepower sprint car. Wrong. I'm sorry, but you know, we got a problem there. So when you ask the question where one of the first things I would do is let's get back to being instructors and get back to teaching and giving these young kids the necessary seat time and the learning curve so that they have the discipline and the mentality and the maturity to move forward. That's my biggest thing.
Okay.
As for the cars, you know, I would like to see the drivers driving the cars. All right, we've got so much body work on these open wheel cars now. You know, one of the things that drew us to open wheel racing as kids was being able to see the drivers saw on the wheel back and forth, and now between the arm guards and this and the other. Okay, here's the deal. Why don't we go back to narrow tires? That right away automatically puts talent back in the driver's hands. That also puts safety back in the driver's hands. All right, we've been talking about the cost of motorsports. Well, you know, again, you're running these high horsepower motors and you're not getting the power to the ground or the track anyway. So why are we doing this? You know, I remember Grandma always telling us as kids, just because you can doesn't mean you should. I'm watching these guys, okay, sprint week, just this last week, Indiana Sprint Week. I'm watching these guys buzz the tires, you know. If we were getting a lot more traction, for one, you wouldn't need these high horsepower, high output motors. You know, you'd have a much higher car count because more people could afford to run. You know, little simple things like that. So I'm going to get off my soapbox here, but you asked the question, so I put it out there.
All right, so here's the last one. This is always a doozy. Yourself, what do you really love about it? Like, what about the whole industry gets you going, gets you moving as far as in the morning or teaching the kids or, you know, whatever aspect of it? How would you sum it up, maybe to somebody coming into the industry, of what you love about it and what keeps driving you to want to be a part of it?
Two things. And they affected me very early on in life. Number one, not only the spirit of competition, but probably more importantly, the camaraderie. All right. We traveled all around the country together to compete against each other. But if we broke something, if we smacked the wall, three of the teams would come with spare parts. Hey, what do you need? How could we help? If we saw each other broke down out on the interstate, instead of waiting for a tow truck or whatever, nine times out of ten, you know, two or three of us would end up pulling over, helping somebody and getting them to the track or getting them back home from the track. So the camaraderie, that's why earlier in the conversation I mentioned of my extended family. Yeah, the camaraderie, the relationships, the friendships, that's what I really, really love about it all. And if we could keep that the forefront as far as the spirit of competition, that's the mentality that will allow this sport to continue to thrive.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add before I close this out?
Well, I'm probably leaving out all kinds of things, but two things. First off, I want to say thank you, Sean, for taking this time and giving me the opportunity to share with you my life's experiences and my perspective as a black man in motorsports. I wouldn't change any of my experiences. I've learned a lot, met a lot of great people. And it's what I live for. It really is.
Well, I really appreciate the time as well. And, you know, one of the bigger purposes for Voices of Racing is to really learn from the people that have been there over the years so the common public can hear their backstories and not just them talking about one particular race that they were involved in and how their head, you know, basically thinks through the whole industry and things that have been problems and things that have been successes and where they think it should go for the future. So it can really not just be entertaining, but more so deeply educational and insightful from each person. And as we grow it, you know, I'm looking forward to, you know, being in connected even people that you've been able to work with and getting their angle or story of how they were able to work with you. You know, that's the other piece. It's not just getting the person's perspective, but it's talking to the people that have worked with them and getting everybody's perspective of how they worked as a team, how they got to that championship, how they, you know, got into the Hall of Fame or whatever the situation is. So I look forward to seeing where this goes and also the race coming up this weekend. The first time Indy Car and NASCAR will be on a road course in the Indianapolis 500. It's going to be a very unique experience in the garages and pits and just to watch it all happen. But I'm thankful for the road ahead, and I'm glad you're in support of what we're doing.
You know, real quickly, since you brought up this weekend's event, this coming weekend's event, and you would ask about who I'm working with, one, just a little inside input, the one you should keep an eye on, there's a young man named R.C. Innerson. He drives for Top Gun Racing. This young man, I am also looking forward to working with. I've already met him. We've had private conversations. This kid gets it. He gets it. And IndyCar, better watch out. I'm really looking forward to working with him in particular this weekend, as well as all of next year. I think the Top Gun Motorsports Racing organization is very, very, very well grounded. And like I say, this kid, R.C. Innocent, keep an eye on him.
Okay, we will.
Keep an eye on him. He gets it.
We will. All right, we'll just stay in the line. But, Greg, I really appreciate your time today.
Excellent. Thank you for your time and, again, for allowing me to speak and share with you my experiences.
You got it. And hopefully everybody who listens to it will be able to get a lot out of it and make them even more motivated to dive more into the history and understanding of the industry itself.
That would be great.
All right.
That really would. That really would, because I could bring up a whole bunch of other things right now, but we won't. We'll save that for another time. Hopefully you can make it out here Tuesday for the fish fry and barbecue.
Oh, yeah. We'll be able to make that happen, too. Talk to some old legends and get some of their stories from, you know, their experiences in the industry.
Excellent. Very good. Well, again, thank you for your time, and I look forward to seeing you.
You got it. And just stay on the line.
Very good.